Till next time, I'm Dime Roberts.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Oddville, a new vaudevillian tradition, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven in Portland. Oddville, a new vaudevillian tradition, is a brand new variety show style monthly night, taking cues from vaudevillian traditions and narrative comedy. Each month's showcase features a different lineup of performers, bringing together a wide range of artistic disciplines and focusing on polished short pieces from our thriving clown, circus, vaudevillian, and alternative performance communities right here in Portland. Again, that's Oddville, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, 1464 Southeast 2nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. From our hands to yours, celebrating 43 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. Michael Graves was an American architect who was identified as one of the New York Five, as well as the Memphis Group. He was known first for his contemporary building designs and some prominent public commissions that became iconic examples of postmodern architecture, such as the Portland Building. The Portland Building opened in 1982 and was considered architecturally groundbreaking at the time. The building houses offices of the City of Portland. It was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 2011. Today on Art Focus, we'll hear a program from the KBOO Archives featuring excerpts from a talk by Michael Graves in Portland in the 1980s, soon after the building opened. The narrator and producer of the program is Susan Reed.
More humanism and less bureaucracy in government. This is what architect Michael Graves has said is needed in the city of Portland. In his recent visit to inspect the completion of the Portland Building, Graves met with more criticism of his design. This time it was not from city council members, nor from fellow architects. It was from civil servants, the new occupants of his creation. People complain that the windows are too small, the glass too dark, the interior finishings cheap and inconsistent. They say the ventilation is too loud and that the soundproofing is inadequate. To answer these clamoring complaints, Graves says that his hands were tied by insufficient funds.
If I had it to do over again, we would probably use clear glass and risk losing the competition on the energy question. I would prefer clear glass. I would prefer slightly larger windows. But we were very much up against trying to make, in this competitive thing that we were involved in with the other architects, trying to get the best building in that regard. So those are some of the reasons behind the size of the window and the color of the glass. I would rather have had the raised ceiling. I would rather had a lot of things. And I think we know how to do that. But in that budget, you can't do it. At $51 a square foot, it was all gypboard city. I can tell you there was nothing there. And it was only by virtue of Philip Johnson's coming back to people like Bill Roberts and saying to city council, this is a public building. This is essentially your new city hall. You cannot do that to the city and to the good people of Portland.
We couldn't afford it. It was another $2 million. We didn't have the money to do that. So we could at least have a polychromed or a colored building by virtue of painting the concrete and giving it some life and using tile sparingly in the building, inexpensive masonry material that can be used to give the building life and bring back some of the joy that one finds in the historical continuum of a place like this. The building is about 30% over-inhabited. And so when you say there isn't space for those places of conviviality and coming together of the people inside, then I guess we're the wrong people to ask about that, in the sense that we'll lighten up city government and maybe there'd be more lounge space. Is there money for the furniture? I'd love for there to be. I'd like to design the furniture. I'd like to make the places, but we weren't asked to do that. Well, part of that is, you know, our lobbying as a culture for money, more money being spent on buildings like our new building here. But at $51 a square foot, it's quite unreal to ask anybody, the architect included, to make it soundproof. It's not going to be that. You know, it's that. What we do have to do is lobby our city governments for great buildings for our city halls, great buildings for our libraries, for our hospitals, etc., rather than the speculative office tower or the bank, for God's sakes, being a better building than the city hall. Who have ever heard of such a thing in any culture?
The Portland building is located on the block between Southwest 4th and 5th Avenues, with Main and Madison as bordering streets. It is sandwiched between the courthouse to the north and City Hall to the south, and it was constructed as a headquarters for the historically scattered city offices of Portland. The building is easy to recognize from a distance, as its colors and form are strikingly different from anything else in the area. Graves complains that he did not have enough money to complete the building according to his plan, but at least the process of initially selecting his design was very inventive. Portland is the first city to hold an international competition in order to design a municipal building. The criteria of the competition was that the building had to be functional as well as aesthetically pleasing. The construction costs could not exceed $22,420,000, and the building had to be a very large and efficient structure. The city council wanted the most for their money and thought that they would get all of these things with the Graves building. Along with this daring selection process, the city council risked a new funding scheme as well. In 1980, they planned to pay for the building by selling 30-year bonds. Interest from the bonds will be derived from the rent paid by stores and shops, which will occupy the main and top floors of the building. But an inflated economy and a weak and unpredictable bond market made the councilors hesitant about risking additional expenses. So corners were rounded, and the interior decoration of floors 3 through 15 were contracted out to a local designer named Robert Frasca. He, too, felt cramped by the city's budget.
And I think there are probably a lot of things that we could have done better. And I think that given a little more money and a little more time, mostly a little more money, I think there were a lot of things that we could have done. First thing was to keep the rain out.
Finally, in the question and answer period between the architects and the city employees, the issue of artistic freedom was raised.
And I think it might be nice to read this one, because, and it's addressed to both Mr. Graves and Mr. Frasca, because it gets us away from the too practical to the more aesthetic. The building is exquisite, but the absence of the rooftop pavilion makes it unfinished. Do you feel that the architect should be allowed to follow the total design once he, she has won the competition? Isn't there some ethical question involved here? Laymen making artistic decisions, particularly regarding a building which reflects a new language. Do either of you want, or both of you want to take that on for a moment?
Go ahead.
Well, I personally regret the loss of that element of the design more than anything that happened in that whole thing. I thought it was really a splendid idea to have kind of this platform at the top of the city where someone other than a bank president or a six-figure lawyer can kind of view the city. And I thought that little kind of pavilion up there was a very nice, a very whimsical and kind of thing, and it gave everyone an opportunity to see their city from a different vantage point. And I guess I agree with the commenter on that it was certainly a great loss. I think it's one of those losses that, like in all buildings, once something happens, it will never be put back. But that's kind of the world that we live in. The architect, as artist, does not have the same control over his canvas that the painter does, as a matter of fact.
I've been commenting on that comment for 20 years now, and I feel two ways about it, I guess. I like the idea that people make comment. I like the idea of this participation. I think our next building will be better. You will say to yourselves, but you're professionals, you should know better. But the patient isn't dead, and I don't think you have to plant ivy on it, but we could do better. All of those things are true, and I doubt my own work as much as Bob doubts his own work, and its architecture is very, very difficult. And I would not come back on this cost question over and over again, or the time question. Bob was under enormous pressure in the development of the interior, so I don't think any of you realize how little time he was given. But to put it in perspective for you, the sculptors for the Portlandia figure were given more time than we were to design the building. So, you know, I sort of leaned over backwards to give the sculptors as much time as they needed, because you can get your sculpture a year from now as well. And the building's not going to pragmatically function any better. It will perhaps symbolically function better with the Portlandia figure. But that time problem is real. The aesthetic question of whether Gore Vidal should say to Norman Mailer, don't build the building, don't write the novel, is one thing. But the question of the layman commenting on the building is another. And it is in a democratic system, in a public building, the requirement of, in this case, the City Council, to vote on this building. If the City Council, however, in not just Portland, but in any town, says to a select panel, you guys know more about this sort of thing than we do, we're picking you to inform us, to tell us, with your expertise, what we should think, in a way. And you've got to convince us that this is the way we should act in this regard. I frankly think that's a more proper way of going about it, which in fact did happen. But the ultimate vote went back to City Council, which in this case became a political vote. And that's too bad, a political in the negative sense. I probably shouldn't say that. Shouldn't put it in the pejorative, but in that sense it was very awkward for all of us to participate in a democratic system, because it was quite nasty at that point. But the question of new language is a very good one, because it is just that problem of new language that makes, on one hand, our life very exciting, but on the other hand, fills us with doubt about whether I'm really off my rocker about those pavilions on the roof, or the garlands, or the color, you know, and there is doubt about all of that. And you can imagine that the City Council, the democratic government, etc., was thrown into great doubt by the professional detractors who were saying, this language is not our language from Portland. This language is another language. Don't believe this language. So it was a very, very tough thing, and one can imagine the questioning that all the folks on City Council had to deal with in their constituents, etc. And the other architects are their part of their constituency. So it's a question I'm not a philosopher, I can't answer that.
Tourists have already started flocking to the building and expressing their opinions.
I think it's very interesting to start with. I was a bit disappointed in the colors from the exterior, but I don't know, it's a dull day and maybe it has something to do with that. I find the interior, again, very interesting, and I like the layout, but I was disappointed in the darkness of it. I find it dark inside here. It is tomb-like, but it's more of a monument, I guess, than a tomb.
I think it's very interesting. Different is the word. Probably the most different thing would be the colors.
It's real different. If the purpose of the architect was to create something, a one-of-a-kind, he succeeded wonderfully.
What does it remind you of?
1920s jukebox. But there's one thing you gotta say. It doesn't go with anything else in this town at all.
You think that's good?
No.
Think that it's out of tune with the Portland personality?
Well, I think, yeah, I do. I don't think this is Portland. I don't even think this is hardly any place that I can think of.
I'm glad to see something besides another glass box. I'm not sure this is the right answer.
It's very rare for a constituency to unanimously approve anything in a democracy, but Graves is also doing something strikingly new. His building is bold and daring. He says he's tired of the modern glass box. He's bored with its sleek but monochromatic style.
It seems to me that the stark reality of what we have, the repetitive forms of those incredibly dreary, dank, stark places that people live in, is the monotony that we must get away from. That doesn't mean that everything has to be different, but the elements within the room, the building, the associative values that one can impart to buildings can repeat. Indeed can repeat, but because of their own internal variety will offer us lots of things to identify with, which an architecture born out of machine technology does not allow. It's in fact does the opposite. It's very alienating, it seems to me.
The city council approved the Graves building over two such modern designs. Graves describes his building as postmodern. In a lecture on its form, he said he was speaking a new language. And he made an analogy between architecture and language.
Colors are used allegorically in all classical architecture. Not that the Portland building, for instance, is a classical building. It certainly is not. It does use, however, allegory and metaphor in the kind of meaning that is imparted to the building by virtue of its texture, its form, and indeed its color. If I use, as I said before, the base is green, or indeed if the base is terracotta or something dense of that sort, it intends to imply the weight of the grounding of the building, the centering of the building within its ground space. If I use blue on the soffit or the ceiling, it is clear, as in a Tiepolo ceiling, that one is in a sense lifting this ephemeral lid off the room. That's what's intended. The kind of color that I use, that I think is almost childlike in the sense of the associative value of color. That for the layman I don't think is very difficult. On the other hand, the particular colors are perhaps more questionable. Why would one make a wall pale terracotta instead of bright red or earthen color, let's say, a literal color? I guess I have been using colors like this for some time in a number of buildings and interiors that we've done, and I, having spent a good deal of time in Europe and in Rome, find that the painting of buildings, or even the buildings that are built out of what I would call real materials like marble and travertine and so on, have faded in time, and over the centuries have taken on a particular tonality that is not true of a more abstract architecture where red is red and blue is blue, but have engendered in the quality and depth of the surface of paint or the material itself a kind of chalkiness, a kind of less than the original stuff that was there. And it seems to me that that kind of light that enters into the surface of the paint or the surface of the material can be used inside as well in a way of reducing the jarring effect of primary colors, and at the same time allowing of the sense of light in the interior that you wouldn't otherwise get. And I suppose the nostalgia of time that comes about, and being an American, being a little more anxious for that civilization to grow on us and be a part of our culture.
Although he says the colors of the building are metaphorical, Graves avoids strict definitions, but the symbolic structure of its design has been discussed by various architectural magazines. Architectural Record said that the vertical columns on the sides of the buildings represent the strength of city government, which supports the commercial interests on the top floor. The giant windows behind the columns suggest the qualities of light and vision which are reflected by government activity upon the city. The garlands on top of the columns are an ancient symbol of welcome. The balconies on the 14th floor act as a precipice for vision and clarity, and the greenish hue of the base is reminiscent of a garden which supports all of humanity. Now here is Michael Graves speaking for himself on his own building.
Now, the problem with this lecture is that the first part of it, the first sort of 10 minutes of it, is that I have to make an analogy between literature and architecture and have you all believe that one might be true for the other, which is always tough because it usually isn't true. But it will help, I think, in this little piece to try to make that analogy. A very serious fellow by the name of Ernst Cassirer talks about standard language and poetic language. And Cassirer reminds us that the two forms are complementary, often deny each other, sometimes support each other, but they are both current and they are both essential to literature. What I'm going to try to do is say that they are both essential to architecture, too. That's where it gets a little bit rocky or fuzzy, because it isn't quite the way it is as we read architecture or understand architecture. But Cassirer talks about the poetic form being that appeals to our mythic and ritual aspirations in society, and the standard form of language being something probably less than prose, but conversation at least, and that one language, one syntax, is always testing the other. And you can see how that is true if we use slang in journalistic or conversational language. The way it might be used poetically, then, and I mean literally by poet, would be used for emphasis, would be used in an assemblage of speech, in a semantic manner, to suggest something beyond the informational value, obviously. A plan of the Portland building is quite orthodox, as you see. Upsetting to some, I suppose, but here's the loggia around the outside edge, and here's the passage through, and here's the, of course, the elevator lobby here, trying to eke out a little bit of goods there on the soffit and chipboard. And then the second floor that we did, which is the our world stops here, the auditorium in the back of the building there, the hearing room and hearing rooms on either side, the minor ones, and then the public gallery here in front. But all that part that I have pocheted or colored there, the public space as you see it, and then the kind of eye for the slides back here in the hearing room, and the kind of termi window expressing the exedra plan of the room, as you see it there. And indeed, we see Schinkel here on the right-hand side with the mirror adjacent, expanding the space, if you will, reflecting the room, the foreground of the room, and putting, in a way, the door, not in the garden wall, but the door in the more ephemeral wall here. And it's the kind of thing that we were bound pragmatically, in our, shall we say, our internal or standard language, to acquire of ourselves in the hearing room, as these behind the Roman grills, this Gaspé fabric used here, will be the absorption, the sound absorption for that room. But at the same time, one expands a closed room, in a sense as the opposite thing, by the Roman grill, by pushing out the wall in the more ephemeral condition of that pragmatic necessity, one gets the symbolic issue as well. The decoration of the building, bad word, I heard it today in the sculpture jury, the decoration was bad. It wasn't expressed quite like that, but it was used in the pejorative. And indeed, the garlands here are decorative. They are symbolic, and at one time, presumably, they did have a pragmatic role when they helped to tie the columns together. Later, they became a sign of welcome for the internal garden of the building. They remain on your city symbol. I don't ask anybody to do as I do. I would never suggest that. I do find that the criticisms that I get of a personal language are not what I want. I want, I guess, to have a language that is general. Certainly everybody's language will be personalized to some extent. But at the same time, I hope that I can contribute to, you can contribute to as architects, as part of, and also as part of society and culture, a re-seeing of the figurative domain, a re-seeing or a relearning of our code. If one sees the appendage of modernism as something that contributed a healthy critique of the Beaux-Arts, etc., and we move further, now one understands as well the alienating problems of machine imagery, the abstractions of an inverted code, the internalized language without the poetic or external symbolic language being expressed in some versions, and only some versions of modernism. I, at least, am in my work, attempting a more figurative and humanistic attitude to the work we do. Thank you very much.
Those were excerpts taken from a slideshow lecture by Michael Graves. Some research for this program was done by Francesca Crowther and Paul D'Amato. This is Susan Reed for KBOO.
You've been listening to a program from the KBOO Archives, produced by Susan Reed in the 1980s. It features excerpts from a talk by the late architect Michael Graves, who designed the Portland building.
Cabo Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Setup, a play that takes place in Hell's Kitchen during the late 1920s. It focuses on a black boxer, an eminent champion, whose return to the ring is secretly set up for defeat. The Setup runs from February 12th through March 5th at the Shaking the Tree Theater, 823 Southeast Grant Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, March 8th, from midnight to midnight, as we celebrate International Women's Day with 24 hours of programming produced, hosted, and engineered by women. There will be live music, public affairs with a feminist focus, and female DJs playing all kinds of music to celebrate the creativity, variety, and zeal of the women of the world. Again, that's Tuesday, March 8th, from midnight to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.